Luke 4:27-28, the local boy who has made good comes back to his home synagogue, and no doubt the old place is packed to capacity. As a man, he is asked to read the scriptures and to explain them. And he does read from Isaiah, verse 17, and he then rolls up the scroll and begins to talk to them. And in verse 22 of Luke 4, we read that all spoke well of Jesus and were amazed at the gracious words that came from his lips, though they were astonished that this should be from one of themselves. There's then rather a change of tone in the preacher. He starts being rather provocative. We won't go into it in verse 23. But in verse 24, he speaks words that are very unpopular. I tell you the truth, he continued, no prophet is accepted in his hometown. In other words, you're not going to accept me, although you start by liking my sermon. I assure you that there were many widows in Israel in Elijah's time, when the sky was shut for 3.5 years, and there was a severe famine throughout the land. Yet Elijah was not sent to any of them, but to a widow in Zarephath in the region of Sidon, that is, right outside Israel. And there were many in Israel with leprosy in the time of Elisha the prophet, yet not one of them was cleansed, only Naaman the Syrian. I prefer Syrian to Aram, or whatever it is in the version, so I'm going to call it Syria from now on. All the people in the synagogue were furious when they heard this and tried to lynch him. Well, it is really an extraordinary change, isn't it? At the beginning of the sermon, they marvel at the gracious words that come from his lips. But before the sermon is out, they are furious at what they hear and want to kill the preacher. I don't suppose there's ever been a change quite as dramatic as that. And what causes them to be so angry is that he says that God's grace is going to go to the Gentiles. And those of you who know your Acts of the Apostles well will remember that when Paul was defending himself before certain people in Acts 22, when he comes to the place that God sends him to the Gentiles, and he testifies to that in front of all these Jews, at that moment the peace is broken and they all shout out. You can find it for yourself later on and want to get rid of him and kill him. That's the point where everybody erupts. The very idea that God should have anything to do with people like us, because we're all Gentiles, we're all outside Israel, but that was too hard for them to bear. Now, if I wanted a title for tonight's talk, indeed all the evening talks, it would be The Grace of God to the Gentiles. That actually is our theme in the morning, because that's what Acts is all about, and that's what the evenings are going to be about too. Only I'm going to make it singular, The Grace of God to a Gentile. And the Gentile in this case is Naaman the Syrian, and we turn back to 2 Kings 5 for him. We're going to spend 4 nights with this particular man. He's a very pleasant man. His name actually means pleasantness, and you'll like him as you get to know him, if you don't know him well. And we shall be back in the synagogue in Nazareth by next Friday night. We shan't get there until next Friday night, but we shall be back there then. And we'll then ask ourselves, really, what was going on in Nazareth that evening. Now, forgive me if some of you have heard me on Naaman. I take the line that until I've understood a thing, I go on speaking about it. Luther wrote a number of commentaries on Galatians, and that was because he didn't think he'd fully understood it. And so I go on learning from Naaman, and I hope you'll go on learning too. But I guess there are many who are here in this evening prayers time who don't know a great deal about Naaman. I hope it'll be a blessing to you, as it'll be a blessing to all of us. Now, there are all sorts of necessary preliminaries that I ought to do before speaking on 2 Kings 5. As we've been watching the open gulf, you notice that some people go on waggling their toes and looking right and left and up and down and throwing grass, and you wonder when they're ever going to get on with it. Golfers are rather like that. They're notorious for waggling on the tee. And some speakers are like that, and I have decided, and those who are regulars at St. Helens may like to know this, I decided to turn my face against this because it's become a very bad habit of mine. I'm listening to a tape, a series of very fine tapes in the car at the moment. I do most of my theological education in the car. And I keep wanting to shout out to this particular man, get to the point. Because by the time we've done half an hour, he's only cleared the ground. Now, what he has to say when we cleared the ground is magnificent. I don't know what the other drivers think on the motorway as they see me shouting in the car. Get to the point. I wanted to say it once or twice in the Evangelical Ministry Assembly. In fact, Stephen and I are producing some notes for the speakers next year. And one of the things we're going to say in the notes is you must have got to your point within half an hour. Now that doesn't seem too hard, does it? But you'll be surprised. There are some magnificent speakers, and there's one who's coming next year who's particularly guilty of this, who at the end of an hour has cleared the ground and begun to plant his tree. And we've really got to get on quicker than that. So I want to assure you that I'm going to leave out all preliminaries. You'll get them sooner or later, mind you, but you're not going to have them at the beginning. I'm only going to give you one preliminary. And that is to say that this story of Naaman in 2 Kings 5 that Derek read just now is not a parable and it is not an allegory. Sunday school manuals down the ages have taught us that it is, but I want to say it isn't. This is not a story about leprosy being an allegory for sin and therefore an allegory of the forgiveness of sins. It was never intended to teach that, it doesn't teach that, and I shan't be teaching that. This is not a parable, it is not an allegory, it is an actual story of an actual person, it's a story of spiritual reality. Now please don't worry if you'll have to get out and come back again. I'm quite used to that. I know it isn't that you dislike the talk. It might be, of course. But you've got a wonderful excuse for going out if you want to, and I shan't think it's because you dislike the talk. I shall think it is because your 13th child has just broken out in mumps or whatever it may be, and people feel that you ought to know about it. This story, then, in front of us is a story of spiritual reality. It's how the grace of God came to a Gentile. And today we're going to look at verses 15 to 18, just three or four verses. Sorry not to start at the beginning. We'll go back to the beginning tomorrow night. But I think you'll see why we don't start at the beginning today, because I want to show you how to recognize, I think we ought to do this right at the beginning of our week, how to recognize a Christian believer. How to know whether in your life there have been the marks of God at work. Marks of regeneration, if you like that word, or renewal. Renewal means exactly the same in the New Testament as regeneration, though some people haven't caught up with that yet. How do I know if my experience, if I have any experience, is a genuine experience? How do I know if God is at work in my life? It's a good question, isn't it? We might as well start there this week. Because if God hasn't been doing anything in your life or in my life, then it's time that he started. And if he has been doing things in our lives, we'd better check out at the beginning of the week to see if what he's doing in our life is the genuine article or it is something that's not so genuine. All sorts of experiences rushing around today, aren't there? Under the name of Christian. And it's rather important to know if they're imitations or if they're the real thing. Let me give you two extremes as I started. One extreme, experience is not mentioned. It wasn't mentioned at church when I was taken along as a boy. I'm thankful, like John, that I was taken to church when I was young. But experience was never mentioned. People believed that they were Christians because they had been baptized and confirmed and were regular members of the church. And yet, as I look back, there weren't many signs of life in that church. I think it would be fair and not unfair to say about those good people that they badly needed to have their assurance that all was well unsettled. They needed really to be shaken up. They needed to ask whether all was as well as they thought it was. But at another extreme, and you will know this one too, experience is strongly emphasized, as it is, of course, often today, and rightly so. It started with the Pietists in Germany, actually. We've been talking about Germany, and the Pietists were great people in the 18th century. They stood against the formalism of their day. They were the antecedents, I suppose, the ancestors of Pentecostal Christians today. And they made it clear that if you had no experience of the love of God, you mustn't imagine that you were really a Christian. Quite right. But sometimes people who talk about experience today press upon us their particular experiences as though we can't lift up our heads and call ourselves Christians if we don't have exactly the same experiences as they have. And that shakes the assurance of real Christians in a way that it oughtn't to. It's a funny thing, isn't it? You've got two extremes. You have people who ought to have their false assurance badly shaken up. Because it is false assurance. It's presumption. But you've got other people who are real Christians who are constantly brought into despair because they meet somebody who's got a new experience which they don't have. And they thought, there must be something wrong with me. So I'm going to draw the anatomy of a real believer tonight. I'm going to give you the signs, they're not all the signs, of course, but three remarkable ones in particular, that are here in front of us in the text. And I want to spend a lot of time in the text of the story rather than talking, in a sense, around it. I want to get right down to it. And we'll start at verse 15. After the great cleansing, Naaman and all his attendants went back to the man of God, Elisha. And he stood before him and said these remarkable words. Now I know that there is no God in all the world except in Israel. As you look at those words, they may not strike you as being extraordinary, but I want to tell you that they are extraordinary words. Here is a man with completely new convictions and a completely new understanding of truth and of God. And three words in particular, if you're taking notes or popping things in the back of your mind, have meant a lot to me as I've been preparing for tonight. The three words are, now I know. Now he knows that the God of Israel is the only God in the whole universe. What an extraordinary thing for a Syrian to say. Because, of course, in those days, every nation had its deity. Everybody believed there was a multiplicity of gods throughout the world. When I was staying in Hong Kong, I remember that my calendar had a different god for every month. And as those of you who've lived in Hong Kong or done business in Hong Kong will know, as you look up at these enormous multi-story flats that there are all over Hong Kong, you see little lights in the windows, which are lights to the gods. And you see, if you go into the flats, you see lots of little tiny places in the flat where a particular god is at least mentioned, if not worshipped, so that we keep in with them. It's just taken for granted that there are many gods. Now, we may not think that's true in the Western world. We don't believe in many gods. We believe in one God, but we're just as much idolaters as anybody else because we think there are many roads to that one God. In other words, there are many religions. It's axiomatic to the education authorities today that all school kids should learn that there are lots of religions, and indeed they ought to know about them. But also behind it is the assumption that they're all really much the same. They're all roads to the one God. There are many, many ways. Now, the Christian doesn't believe that. The believer in the Old Testament and the believer in the New Testament stood apart from their contemporaries and the universal consensus. They stood apart then and now in believing that there is only one God who has revealed himself in only one way. In the Old Testament, that was eccentric to think that. In the New Testament, as you will well know, your friends will think it's very dogmatic and perhaps rather narrow-minded to talk like that. It's marvelous, actually, to follow this in the Bible. I was going to turn to Jonah, but there isn't time to turn to Jonah. But you remember how Jonah was asleep and was found out by the people when the storm came, and they shook him, and they asked him what he was doing and what he believed. And there's a rather noble confession of faith as Jonah stands up in the boat and says, I believe in the creator of heaven and earth. Of course, in that way, he was quite different from all the other people because they believed in lots of gods. And then you remember later on, he went on to preach for that God in Nineveh. And when the people repented, God had mercy on them. And Jonah said to God, well, that's just like you. I knew I couldn't trust you. I knew the moment that you saw a tear of repentance, you'd forgive them. You're a gracious God, and I know that... I know you can't be trusted to be anything else. Jonah was in a very bad temper because he wanted God to zot the Ninevehs off, as John Chapman would say. But very interesting, you see, in that quite, as you might think, unimportant book in the Old Testament, Jonah has only two things to say about God, and they're quite unique. Nobody else knows them, and they're still unique. Christian theology has never got beyond them. Jonah says there's only one creator in heaven and earth, and he's a gracious God. And he can't be trusted to be anything else. And that's unique to the Old Testament and unique to the New Testament. Nobody else has ever said that in any other religion in the world. And on this occasion, this brilliant soldier, who I imagine had a knowledge of theology which was zero, suddenly discovered the gracious God. And he said, now I know that there is a real God. I imagine until that thing, the only things that he knew about were military maneuvers, wouldn't you? Syria and Israel are bitter enemies today, and they were bitter enemies then. It really hasn't changed. And Syria, well, I should think the general in charge of Syria knew all about the Israeli army. But I shouldn't think he knew one bit about God. Turn over to 1 Timothy chapter 2 and verse 4. If you happen to have got this Bible that we're using in Brunel, the Gideon Bible, it's 1 Timothy 2, 4, is on page 1107. And we have here a very remarkable definition of what it means to be saved. We're told that it pleases God our Savior in verse 3, who wants all men to be saved, 1 Timothy 2, 4, and, now, watch this, because this is a definition of what it means to be saved. You may not like that phrase, being saved. It is rather a cliche, isn't it? It rather irritates some people when they hear people talking like that. It might slightly irritate you to be asked, are you saved or not? Well, let's change the language. You see, verse 4 says, who wants all men to be saved and to come to a knowledge of the truth. That's what it means to be saved. It is to come to a knowledge of the truth. It's a good definition, isn't it? Well, is this being very intellectual? You know, some people accuse St. Helens of being intellectual. I want to make a distinction. I don't think it's being academic. I don't think the Bible is wanting us to be academic. But I do think that the Bible talks about our minds being enlightened. I mean, you surely met somebody who's had no education, Bill the Boiler Man, who's become a Christian, and you find that Bill is full of convictions. He may know more than the vicar in the parish next door. Haven't you found that? You see, it's a strange thing, isn't it? He hadn't had a day's education. He left school when he was 12, in the days when many people did leave school at that age. And yet, when it comes to the things of God, he's got great convictions and great knowledge. The fog is cleared, unlike at Muirfield during today. And people can see where they're going now. They've got a knowledge of the truth, and they desire to know more. I mean, isn't it very striking that when the early first Christians repented and believed on the day of Pentecost, we're told that the moment they repented and believed and received the Holy Spirit, they devoted themselves to the apostles' teaching and fellowship and prayers. But notice the first thing. They devoted themselves to the apostles' teaching, doctrine. That's a strange thing to happen, isn't it? I mean, before I became a Christian, I didn't want to worry about that sort of thing at all. I couldn't imagine. I thought it was deadly dull. They had this tremendous thirst to know. Actually, that's always been a mark of Christianity. I think probably it's going to be a very important part of Christian outreach in the next 20 years in this country. I think that there are many people who badly need a touch with the Christian church, not only to know about God, but to have any knowledge at all. I think we probably have no idea of the state of education in many of our inner cities. If you work in Bethnal Green, you'll know that many of our boys and girls don't go to school at all in Bethnal Green, and the teachers are glad that they don't, because they can't cope with what they've got. And you'll have heard some of our leaders when they take the young people away. I remember a leader saying to me a little time ago that he asked one of the boys, a teenager, what station they'd come to. They'd had a hike and they'd come to a station. And they suddenly realized what a silly thing it was to ask, because the boy couldn't read the name on the station. First time I ever met somebody who was completely illiterate, it was in Birmingham Cathedral when we had some businessmen's addresses there. And that boy was converted to Christ, and I don't need to ask. I know perfectly well that he'd have learned to read straight away. It's the greatest incentive to learn to read, to come to know the truth. It's not just, you see, that this man had come to know the truth from nothing. Well, he'd come to know the truth from nothing. But the same thing brings a person to know the truth from error. Turn to Acts chapter 9. Acts chapter 9. Now, Saul of Tarsus on the road to Damascus was in great error about Christianity. He was a very clever man indeed. He had convictions, convictions that caused him to want to kill the Christians. So you see, we have convictions without being a Christian, obviously. His convictions were wrong. In fact, these are some of the most dangerous people in life, who have religious convictions, political convictions that are quite wrong. And they want to drive everybody else into their camp. Well, now look at Acts chapter 9, verse 18. Just after Saul has been converted and he's become this new man. Verse 18, immediately something like scales fell from his eyes. He could see again, he was baptized, he took food, he regained his strength. Verse 20 has always struck me as being an amazing verse. Acts 9, 20. At once, notice, at once, he went off to evening school to learn about his new faith. Now, it doesn't say that. At once, he began to preach in the synagogues that Jesus is the Son of God. Verse 22, he grew more and more powerful and baffled the Jews living in Damascus by proving that Jesus is the Christ. Something had happened, hadn't it? See, come to know the truth. He could say, now I know what I didn't know even 2 days ago, that Jesus is the Son of God. Not only I know it for myself. You know, a lot of people going around saying, I know it for myself, but I couldn't explain it to anybody else. That's not much good, is it? Not only does he know it for himself, but he can go up to these learned Jews who've got the whole of the Old Testament wrapped up, who've done nothing but study it, and he can confound them. That's remarkable, isn't it? This is one of the great signs that God has begun to work in our minds, in our lives, that enlightenment has come to us so that we can say, however simply, now I know. I think of the late Professor R.V.G. Tasker. He was a professor of New Testament in London University at King's College along the Strand. Many of you will know it. He was a liberal, which means that he didn't believe things like the miracles and so on. He was very characteristic of his age. He was a man who took the Bible to bits and so on. But he was drawn along to Westminster Chapel in the war years. I think I've got my dates right. And he listened to the preaching of Dr. Martin Lloyd-Jones. And bit by bit, God met with him and changed his life completely upside down. And one of the most remarkable things that happened to that distinguished professor was that he began to believe the Bible. In fact, he was the editor of the first IVP series of New Testament commentaries, and some of you will have them on your shelves. The editor of the first series of commentaries after the war, which was committed to the trustworthiness of the Bible, was a man who himself had had his whole mind changed by meeting with Christ. Very, very remarkable change. He could have said, as a professor, and did say to his students, now I know that the Bible is the Word of God. If you look at this language in 2 Kings 5, you'll find that it's negative, and that's very important. He stood before him and said, now I know there is no God in all the world except in Israel. You see, it isn't enough to say, now I know that your God is okay. So there's a lot of that going on today, isn't there? You know, we try to be polite. I think your God is splendid, and of course mine is too. You'll agree with that if I agree with that. He doesn't say that. He says, I know now there's no God except yours. Now, the Bible is very like that. John 14:6, I am the way, the truth, and the life. That's the positive. The negative, no one comes to the Father but by me. There's a minister who comes occasionally to our conferences who was a Jehovah's Witness until he was 37 years of age. He was an expert at knocking on people's front doors and persuading them that Jehovah's Witnesses were right. But one day, I don't know the full details of the story, he met a Christian who knew his Bible. And what turned his life upside down was a negative. Don't bother to turn it up. I'll read it to you. It's in the beginning of John. Those of you who've argued with Jehovah's Witnesses at the front door will know that they love the first two or three verses of John's Gospel, in which they try to point out that Jesus is a word and not the word. And it was verse 3 that changed his life. Verse 3 goes like this. Listen to it. Here's the positive. Through him, that is the word, all things were made. No one will disagree with that, maybe. But it was the next bit, the negative. You see, John then turns it upside down and says, without him, nothing was made that has been made. And that's one of the most remarkable negatives, isn't it, in the whole of John's Gospel. See, if you're going to say with the Jehovah's Witnesses that Jesus is part of the created order, you could say that Eve was part of the created order, but he helped God to make things, but you're faced with this sentence very difficult. Without Jesus, nothing was made that has been made. And if you work that out logically, if you can't work it out now, take it away and think about it, it means that Jesus cannot be part of the created order. He'd never seen that before. Never seen that tremendous negative. Jesus not part of the created order as the Son of God. Now that's what Naaman is doing then, and this is what tells us that Naaman is a truly converted man, to use that language, or a truly renewed person, to use that language, or a truly believing person, because he says, not I feel different, but I know there is no God in all the world except the God of Israel. Turn back a few pages to 1 Kings 17:24, and you will find, and in this cycle of stories, you find this little phrase several times, but you'll find it at the end of chapter 17 with the woman, the widow of Zarephath, who is also mentioned in the synagogue sermon. And she says, now I know that you're a man of God. Very briefly, the story was that Elijah holed up with this widow woman in a time of drought. And she was very good to him. She fed him with the barrel of meal that never gave out. And no doubt, late in the evening, since there wasn't television to watch, Elijah would tell the widow woman about the great God, of which she knew nothing, because she was a pagan, about the great God, the creator of all the heavens and the earth. And they would think about this God, and he would also tell the woman about his ministry, this terrible ministry that God had given him of judgment and condemnation. You know, it's the worst ministry anybody was ever given in the Bible. Wherever Elijah went, there were calamities and judgments. Just imagine being given a ministry like that. Yesterday, the reason I couldn't come down yesterday was I went to celebrate a silver wedding. I've been going to a number of friends' silver weddings. In fact, I'm just going through that period of life where all my friends have their silver weddings coming up. They keep coming up to me and saying, you put down, haven't you, March the 4th or February the 1st or whatever it is. It's a delight to go. You know, we hear all these statistics of people who divorce. It's rather nice, isn't it, to hear of those who are celebrating their silver weddings. And we had a great day yesterday. A great day. He's actually the vicar of a parish. There was a marquee on the wall. I won't tell you all about it. It was a great day. And I was asked to speak. And just imagine having been given by God a ministry of condemnation and judgment, so that all I could do was to leave misery behind. Wouldn't that be terrible? Wouldn't that be awful? You remember that this really was Elijah's ministry. You remember when Ahab meets him in chapter 18, he says, oh, you troubler of Israel. And that's absolutely right. Ahab wasn't telling a lie. He was a troublemaker. Wherever he went, there was trouble. And he went to this widow, and he held out, and he stayed with her in this little tiny place. And before any time had gone by, her son died. And she says to him, I think somewhere in the story, it's just the same as ever. You brought my sins to your remembrance. You are a most wretched man. What are you doing here? I don't want you here because you've got a ministry of judgment and condemnation. I can't bear it. And you remember Elijah couldn't bear it either. And he took the child up to his room. Do you see in verse 23? And he knelt down, earlier on, stretched himself on the child and cried to the God to give him life back again. And God heard Elijah's cry, verse 22. And Elijah picks up the child and carries him down and gives the child to his mother and says, look, your son is alive. And the woman then said, verse 24, now I know that you're a man of God. Now why did she say that? She knew that before, you see. That's a very interesting reason, isn't it? You see, calamity doesn't prove that God is around, does it? I mean, children do die, don't they? Without any divine judgment. But people never get raised from the dead without God being around. See, judgment and calamity is just part of life, isn't it? But resurrection from the dead isn't. So she can never be absolutely sure, you see, about Elijah and this God that he preached about, because Elijah had said this was a creator God, and all that happened when Elijah was around is destruction, not creation. But now she saw in front of our eyes recreation. A son that was dead is now alive again. She says, now I know that there's a creator God. How else could you know? How else could you know? See, now I know is the language of real conviction. Once I was blind, but now I see. I want to ask you tonight, by the mercy of God, is that the language you can use? Now I know. It may not be very much that you know, but you have definite convictions that Jesus Christ is God's Son, that the Bible is God's book. Now I know. Jesus once said to his disciples that they were blessed, that there were many who would want to have known what they'd known and seen what they'd seen, but not been able. And I think he'd say that to us today. What privileges we have to know God. And that's the first mark, one of the first marks at any rate, that God has begun to work in our lives. New understanding about him. Wouldn't you expect God to give you that? He doesn't want to be a God who we don't know. Now back to 2 Kings 5 for the second thing. The second thing I'm going to be very brief about. It's fairly obvious, I think. You'll see it at the end of verse 15. He says, please accept now a gift from your servant. And the prophet answered, as surely as the Lord lives, whom I serve, I'll not accept a thing. And even though Naaman urged him, he refused. Now, Elisha's position was very understandable, wasn't it? If you know anything about paganism in history, or if you know anything about paganism in the world today, for example, if you've ever been to a country where there are holy men and holy shrines, you will know that in paganism you never get religious blessings without paying for them. The holy man of India always has his hand out. That is always so. It's universal. Can be so, alas, in the church too. Shouldn't be. One of the reasons when we started at St. Helens, we didn't make any appeal to the city at all. We were very careful not to, because we wanted to make it quite plain that we had something to give. And that we went out to beg from people what they had. I think sometimes we need to be careful about that again, lest there should be any misunderstanding. Elisha didn't want any misunderstanding at all. God can't be bought. And yet it is almost laughable, isn't it? I remember once I was in a church in Tokyo where there was a great old character called Mr. Obara. He was a hero in Tokyo because he'd been a Christian during the war, and to be a Christian in Tokyo during the war was very unpopular indeed. He'd been imprisoned. He's a great old Christian warrior. And the church lived in great awe of Mr. Obara throughout Japan. And I had the great privilege of preaching in his church one evening, but I didn't think I was going to, because he got up and started preaching. He was going preaching for about 20 minutes. And I thought all my precious time was going. And I asked my little interpreter, I said, what's he going on about? I said, this is a great sermon. What's it about? Well, he said, it isn't a sermon. He's telling them to give. I never heard. I mean, you could tell that they were being really forced to put their hands in their pockets. There's no doubt about that. Terrific stuff. Well, I suppose we're familiar with that, aren't we? But you see, here is an almost ludicrous example of the other way round. Here the new convert comes and says, I want to give, and the minister says, no, you can't. Have you ever heard of such a thing? Well, it is a mark, I think, of the change in people's lives, that instead of the flow being give me, it is take from me, let me give to you. Indeed, just as we have to urge the non-Christian, if we ever want him to give, we sometimes have to urge the Christian to stop giving. Actually, learning to give is a very difficult thing. And many of our Christian businessmen have had to learn a whole new art of life when God has blessed them in business, because learning to give is quite difficult. What shall I give to? What are the causes that are really worthy? How shall I do it? But what a wonderful thing to want to. We're giving, of course, not because we're good, but because God has given to us. That's the rule of the road in the Christian life. When God has given you something like his love in your heart, then you have to pass it on immediately if you don't want to lose it. That's the rule. You know that rule in the Christian life, don't you? You have to give away what he gives you if you don't want to lose it. Does that make nonsense to you? He forgives you, so you must quickly forgive the person you have a grudge against if you don't want to lose the joy of his forgiveness. He gives you his love, you must pass that on. And I find I'm constantly forgetting that, and that's why these things grow stale on us, because we don't pass on what God has given to us.
So this man has been given much, so he gives naturally. It's a sign of his gratitude.
And I think that is one of the surest signs that God is at work in us. Just simply this. None of the signs I'm mentioning tonight are strange or eccentric or exaggerated. You don't have to speak in tongues to prove that you're a Christian, but you do have to speak in gratitude. You do have to speak in gratitude. The children may have been an unbelievable pest for the last few weeks. But you and you two, as you meet together perhaps one evening, you pray together and you say to God, we're just so thankful for them. May have been a bad year in business for you. May have had a really tough time. And yet you're still thankful for the past year. May have been a hard time in the family. There may have been illness. And yet you find yourselves together praying and saying to the Lord that you're thankful for what you've been through. You've learnt so much through it. You may have been misunderstood. There are a thousand things that may have happened to you in the last year, and yet you find yourself down here thankful. That's a miracle, isn't it? The world isn't thankful. First thing I learned when I joined the Mediterranean Fleet as a midshipman is that I learned the word dripping. The metal is drip all day long. The word that is used on the lower deck is drip. That is, you complain about everything. The officers, the food, the shore leave, everything. Drip, 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 drip. Most of the bulkheads are dripping anyhow in the heat. And, you know, the water's coming down and you're dripping too. And that's the natural way of the world, isn't it? We drip about the weather, we drip about British Railways, we drip about everything. And I'm not saying there isn't a lot to complain about. And I'm not saying that I never complain. But let's get back the flow. You see, there's an urgency. But what he's saying is this, take me. He's saying to Elisha, take it, use it. Let me make a contribution. I'm a debtor. Now, that's the genuine article, isn't it? When you say, oh, take something from my life. Use something, Lord. Let me make a contribution before it's too late. Let me do something for you. That's the sign, isn't it? That means God is at work in you. That is a sign, not that you've turned over a new leaf, not that you've reformed yourself, but that you've been renewed by the Spirit of God. You see, the more and more we look at this story, it's not an allegory, it's not a parable, it's a reality. This man's life has been changed. He hasn't simply been cured of his leprosy. What an absurd idea to imagine that that's all that had happened to him. First, he's got new convictions about God that soldiers generally don't have. And secondly, his wallet has been so converted that he's holding it out to Elisha, and Elisha is saying, no, I'm sorry, I can't. And so when we get to verse 23, and Gehazi comes out, and he must have, I mean, he was a very eminent soldier. Don't you think he could see through Gehazi? I think he must have been very suspicious. Nevertheless, when Gehazi tells all these fibs, we'll come on to them later in the week, he says, verse 23, by all means, take two rather than one. There's the spirit, isn't it, of this man? Generous, outgoing, outreach. That's the mark, isn't it, of the real church and the real Christian. We want to share with others what God has given us. Oh, we're always failing on it, of course. We're always getting selfish again. We're always finding that everything is coming back to little me and so on. But when the Holy Spirit begins to work with us, out it goes again. We have to. We're thankful. Now, third and lastly. Well, if you won't take it, said Naaman, please let me, your servant, be given as much earth as a pair of mules can carry. For your servant will never again make burnt offerings and sacrifices to any god but the Lord. Now, what is happening here? Well, he's got to go back to Rimmon. And the king leans on his arm. That means the king leans on him. We're told here that the king has him very high regard, verse 1. He's got to go back. And so we see him going into the house of Rimmon for the morning worship, and behind him come two men from the parks and gardens staff. They have a sack of soil on their shoulders, and they empty the soil in front of Naaman, and he stands on it. Because, of course, that was a vivid way of telling his people who believed that the God of Israel was simply a national God and belonged simply to their soil. What he's saying is, I brought Israel's soil because I believe in Israel's God. Now, that can't have been very easy for his wife, can it? She's up in the gallery, you know, just off on her way to a bridge party. And the other wives afterwards, they put her really through. What was your husband doing today? What was all that nonsense about the soil? You know, when husbands are first converted, it can be very embarrassing for wives sometimes, and the other way around, of course. When the first person in the family begins to take God seriously, I can remember when I first became a Christian in my teens and wanted to confess it openly, it was tremendous embarrassment to my family. You know, they said, you mustn't do anything like that within this town. And I'm still, by some of my relatives, forbidden to preach in Lewis. I occasionally break the rule just to show there's a little bit of freedom around. But it's embarrassing to some of our relatives, isn't it, when we go off like a Sputnik. And sometimes, of course, we do it insensitively. I'm not saying we always do it right, but we have a great desire to do it. We at least want to run the flag up. We know that unless we do that, we shall perish. We know that God has said that we've got to confess with our lips. We know that in the end we've got to plunge in and that we're going to make some people wet by so doing. We have to do it. So I think it is very striking to see what he's doing. He's got a new sensitive conscience. He's got the courage to confess Israel's God when he's the general in charge of the Syrian army. That takes a bit of doing. His job would be at risk. His wife's reputation would be at risk. Everything is at risk, but he's going to do it. And I would have you know, I'd have you notice, you see, many people are shocked by the fact that Elisha says, go in peace. You notice that there's this picture right the way through the Bible. There's no suggestion that I become a believer in God and therefore I retreat. Oh, I say, I won't go back to the house of Rimmon now. I won't go back into that country. There's never any suggestion of that. I find that very interesting, too. You find Obadiah in King Ahab's household, in charge of all his household. Imagine being in charge of King Ahab's household with Jezebel all around the place. And Obadiah, we're told, was a man who believed in the Lord with all his heart. He was in that difficult place. He didn't pull out of it. I mean, you may be chucked out of it. And for all we know, Naaman was chucked out of this job, but he didn't pull out of it. He had this intense desire to continue his responsibilities now as a believer and to make it quite plain where he stood. And I want you to notice the words as we close that I was very moved with today. I don't think I've ever really noticed them before, but a modern translation often helps, doesn't it, to bring it alive, verse 17. Your servant, halfway down verse 17, your servant will never again make burnt offerings and sacrifices to any other god but the Lord. So you put those two together, verse 15. Now I know there is no god in all the world except in Israel, no other god. And then verse 17, I will never again worship any other god but this God. I will never again. Isn't that very striking? I'm going back into the house of Rimmon. I'm going back into the city. I'm going back into the markets. I'm going back into university, into that class where everybody's an unbeliever and laughs at the believers. I'm going back to school, maybe, where it's jolly hard to be a Christian. But I will never again worship any other god but the Lord. Well, that's a sign that a man's been changed, isn't it? No doubt about that. Now, can we summarize these three signs? You see that they're not at all exaggerated. I am fed up with eccentric Christians who go around spreading eccentric experiences. Fed up with it. Because Christianity is not a matter of eccentric experiences. It's a matter of, shall I tell you what it is a matter of? It's a matter of keeping the first commandment and the second, but the first is the one that I want to talk about as I finish. The first commandment says, you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, and strength. That's, of course, the very last thing we do by nature. Do you see what has happened to this man is quite simply, God has made it possible for him to keep the first commandment. First, by teaching him that there is no other God to love, and secondly, by teaching him not to give love to any other power. You see, that's all. As simple as that. The whole purpose of this work of God in his soul is to make him recognize who God is and recognize that he must give to God alone the worship that is due to him and to no other rival. But there's nothing eccentric about that, is there? That's just basic Bible
faith and life.
God's grace alone can do this and can give us a desire to love God and never again to give our love to a false god. As I was coming down from my room, having prepared those notes, I brought for my holiday this book, Elspeth Huxley, Out in the Midday Sun. Some of you will know her writings. I'm very fond of East Africa and Kenya in particular, and she's a marvelously evocative writer of what it was like to be in East Africa in the early years as a settler. And as you read it, of course, they were incredibly worldly. They really had no thought for God at all. It was just a blissful life. Everything was cheap. Everything was easy. It was like heaven on earth. But as you read it, you can't help thanking God that you've been, in a sense, spared that kind of life. Because they never came, as far as I've got, you never meet anyone who could say, now I know there's one God in heaven and earth. And you never meet one who says, now I want to give to that God my life. And as a result of giving to God that life, I want to be consistent in my life for him in the few years that remain to me. You know, this sort of thing just wasn't in their minds at all. They wanted the good life without God. And frankly, if you and I had been in their shoes, we should have been exactly the same. Aren't we fortunate that God had mercy on us and opened our eyes to see that there is a God and that we have to give our lives to him and be consistent in the world for him, and that that's the only thing that makes life make any sense at all? I think we're very fortunate indeed. And that's what happened to Naaman, but we'll find out what more happened to him tomorrow. Let's pray.